From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. The government's taking of private property for public use or eminent domain is a long-standing practice in the U.S. A 2005 Supreme Court decision expanded the use of eminent domain, allowing governments to take private property for private benefit and not just for public use. Supporters of broad eminent domain powers say it can result in economic redevelopment, but a pair of Florida Gulf Coast University economics professors recently published a study showing that just the opposite is true. We'll take a closer look. Plus, a living legend in American art comes to Naples this month for a retrospective exhibition of some of his most iconic work. We'll talk with world-renowned artist Peter Max. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. A collection of works by iconic American artist Peter Max comes to Southwest Florida this month. Max's work has been said to have done to the visual art world what the Beatles did for music. His paintings are displayed in hundreds of galleries around the world, and his work has graced the covers of thousands of magazines. In addition to painting for five U.S. presidents, Max has been the official artist for five NFL Super Bowls, the 2006 Olympics, the World Series, and the U.S. Open, to name just a few. Max himself will make appearances at the retrospective exhibition in Naples this weekend. We'll talk with Peter Max about his extensive body of work, his creative process, and what's next for the artist. That conversation's coming up later this hour. But first, the government's taking of private property for public use or eminent domain is a long-standing practice in the U.S. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Kelo versus the City of New London in 2005 expanded the use of eminent domain, allowing governments to take private property for private benefit and not just for public use. The motivation behind broader eminent domain powers is that it can result in economic redevelopment, reduced unemployment, and increased government revenue. That idea has gone largely unchallenged, but a pair of local economic professors recently published results of a study showing that this expanded eminent domain doesn't result in those economic benefits, and in fact, may have the opposite effect. That paper was written for the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Joining me now are the authors of that study, Florida Gulf Coast University Associate Professors of Economics at the Luckert School of Business, Drs. Carrie Kurikas and Dean Stansel. Dean and Carrie, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us, John.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. You can connect with our guests with a phone call to 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. Post comments and questions on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, or join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And first of all, let's define precisely what we mean when we use the term eminent domain. Carrie, do you want to take that one?
When we're talking about eminent domain, it would be government taking property, and it's changed meaning over time. Initially, as set forth in the Constitution of the United States, it was supposed to be the government would be taking property for public uses. So traditional public uses that people would think about would be things like highways or schools, things of that nature. Over time, those definitions have changed, and I would say become a little bit more relaxed. In some cases, it's been used for redevelopment purposes. If cities are trying to revitalize. What we're looking at, particularly in our paper, is the use of government to be able to take property, not to transfer it from to be using it for public purposes, but actually transferring it from one person to another individual, so more for private benefit versus for public benefit. So we were looking specifically at what had happened following the 2005 Kelo decision. And in that instance, you were having property being taken with the claim that it would help to increase your tax base or could be decreasing unemployment. So more of those private benefit purposes versus its intentional use.
And let's talk about that 2005 U.S. Supreme Court decision. Was that really a game changer in terms of how eminent domain is allowed to be used?
That was a game changer, and at the time there was a lot of controversy around that decision, people thinking that then government's going beyond the original scope of how that should be used. And again, now it's going to increase, make it easier for entities to be able to take property from one individual, and one fear is that now things like maybe churches could be taken to now have other plans for that property, which would be generating more tax revenue. So it really makes property more insecure. And that was a lot of the controversy and the fear of that decision, that you'll see more of this happen and that more property would be taken.
One of the bright sides in terms of the response to that decision is that it really energized property rights advocates all over the country, and virtually every state did something to strengthen the state-level protections against this. So there has been a response that has kind of mitigated the negative effect, but still it was a really a landmark decision that really put a knife in the heart of private property rights.
And just to be clear, does eminent domain necessarily require that private landowners be compensated appropriately, and how would that be determined?
They are supposed to be compensated if it's taken for eminent domain. The problem with that is the amount of money that a landowner would consider to be of value to them is going to differ from what the government is going to be compensating them for. So if you have a piece of property and you're not willing to sell, you're likely putting a much greater value on that than the money that you're going to receive. So I wouldn't say that it's going to be fair compensation in the minds of the landowners that have to give their property up.
Okay. And what limits exist on government's eminent domain powers? I know there's clauses in both the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments regarding that. In your opinion, did the Kelo decision kind of violate your interpretation of those protections?
In my opinion, yes. I would say that it has been weakened significantly over time. So there's some other landmark cases that have led to that. So it didn't happen all at once. I would say the 2005 decision is yet another case in a stream of decisions that have taken it away from what the Fifth Amendment had set forth, being that it's for public use versus what it is now, where it could be something claiming that tax revenue or jobs are going to then benefit people, and it's enough for government to be able to take that property.
And the Kelo case was the first major case involving eminent domain that the nation's highest court had taken up since the earlier mid-80s. I think it was 84. And Carrie, you had touched on this a moment ago about broadening eminent domain powers. Is that really what had been happening in that stretch of time between the early 80s and this 2005 decision?
Yeah, I would say it's definitely broadened the powers. What happened in this specific case is that you had property that was being taken. Pfizer was building a pharmaceutical company in New London, Connecticut, and some of the thought was that by taking these homes, you would have research facilities for that company, you would have some retail space, you were going to have this whole complex going in that would be hopefully helping that neighborhood, and that then would be the private – that would be the benefit that would accrue to others. The problem is that you're really transferring the property from individual property owners to other private firms that are then going to be benefiting from that. So it was different from when property had been taken in other cases.
Sure. And to make matters worse, of course, the timing was horrendous because the economy went in the tank and the development never happened. So they tore down all these homes, and they ended up after – I think it was Hurricane Irene – they ended up using the site for a dump to put storm damage. So none of the development they were planning happened, and all the losses for people like Suzette Kelo, who lost her famous pink house, did occur.
Yeah, and that does make that case particularly egregious. But what about other similar instances where, say, the economic redevelopment plan actually did go through? You know, they took grandma's old dilapidated farmhouse, you know, they put in some retail space, companies came in, they hired employees, people spent money, government revenue increased. You're saying that doesn't happen?
Not always. And I would say one of the problems with redevelopment is you have some group that's trying to plan what they think would be the best way to redevelop. And a lot of times those plans aren't going to be in line with what would work best for that area, or taking into considerations, you know, people in the surrounding areas. So trying to plan redevelopment isn't always going to actually work that way. Individuals often have better information about how land should be used. And so all these grand schemes, I have my doubts as to whether they can come to fruition well, as we hope.
Right. Not only that, but it's an unlevel playing field in the sense that, you know, Pfizer's a huge corporation. The mom and pop who wants to open a new store, they're not going to get the benefit of an eminent domain taking and having land given to them. And so it creates this unlevel playing field. It's only it's cronyism in a sense. It's only those who are politically well-connected and financially powerful that are the ones that are going to get the benefit of these redevelopment takings.
And where did the concept originate that using eminent domain in this way, particularly for economic redevelopment, would be beneficial because, as you note in the paper, it's something that's largely gone unchallenged. And as I was saying, you know, just before we went live, what I found so intriguing about the findings is that, at least on the surface, they seem kind of counterintuitive.
Sure. So I mean, it seems logical, right, to you, John, and to most people, that if you have a what some people think of as a dilapidated area where it's relatively low property values, if we tear all that out and put in something new, how could it not improve the economy, right? And so yeah, it seems commonsensical. And like you said, one of the reasons that – one of the motivations for this project was that we were looking around and the claim for eminent domain is, well, it's going to help the economy. No one's really challenged it. So we collected some data. There's a libertarian public interest law firm in D.C. called the Institute for Justice, and they had put together two surveys of the amount where they were measuring the amount of eminent domain for private redevelopment, not to build schools, not to build roads, but the type of thing we're talking about in the Kelo case. So they tracked it by state. And so it was perfect data set for us to use to measure the level of activity. And then we just collected data on revenue and other types of factors that could affect revenue. So we hold those other things constant. And, you know, we ran the statistical regressions and such, and we found that essentially there's no – virtually no evidence that of this positive relationship that they're talking about between eminent domain activity and the level of revenue. And so then we said, well, let's look at growth of revenue. And we found some evidence for a negative relationship between eminent domain activity and the growth – the future growth of revenue. So revenue grew slower in states that had more eminent domain for private redevelopment activities, according to this data set in our paper. Now, you know, we don't want to – make too broad of a claim here, right?
Sure.
I mean, in economics, we test theories and we do the best we can, and someone will come back later and retest it with another data set, and hopefully our findings are robust. Maybe they aren't, but that's what it's all about in, you know, the search for knowledge.
Governments in the U.S. can use eminent domain for purposes of economic redevelopment and increasing tax revenue, but a recent study by FGCU economics professors Drs. Dean Stansel and Carrie Karikas show just the opposite is true. You can join our conversation with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 1-877-GCU-TALK. That's 877-428-8255. Join our live Twitter chat using hashtag Gulf Coast Live or comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. And I was curious about how extensive your study was. Did you look at specific instances of eminent domain use in different types of communities in multiple states?
No, it's not looking at particular
it's
examples.
It's not looking at specifics. Okay.
Yeah. So the data on the eminent domain activity was, again, was put together using what were they using? Like stuff from the media. They did an exhaustive search. Mm-hmm. Institute for Justice did an exhaustive search of reports of eminent domain projects for private redevelopment. So it was limited to that type of thing, but
okay.
Not a particular type of private development, just all of them ones that there was data for. And they aggregated that at the state level so that we had one number for each state. And there were two time periods we were looking at.
Yeah, that was something else I wanted to ask about, because particularly with the Kelo case, as you mentioned before, that failed to come to fruition in some degree because of, you know, the economy collapsing. Did you look at, you know, what were the time periods you were looking at there? Because if the economy was bad, you know, that I would imagine that might skew the results you could get.
Sure. So the second time period they looked at was the 12 months following the Kelo decision. So Kelo
okay.
opened up the floodgates and they said, well, let's look at what happened then. And the first time period was 94 to 98?
It was 98 to 2002.
98 to 2002. So that was in the height of the economy booming. It wasn't in the recession or anything like that.
And what about the effects of eminent domain restrictions that some states sought to put in place following the Kelo decision? Did limiting eminent domain for private use have much of an impact on local economies?
I'd say it depended. A lot of those restrictions, it varied by state. So you would have some that might have made changes that were more changes maybe on paper, even to appease voters or make people feel better about the situation, and others might have actually had more teeth to them. Something else to keep in mind is if it would become more difficult to use eminent domain, people would respond to that, and there might be ways of getting around it. For example, you could try to have fight for different regulations in place or different restrictions on land. So even if you're make it more difficult to use eminent domain, there might be other methods that people could go to try and use property.
Yeah, I mean, furthermore, just our data set didn't address that in the sense that it was the 1 year after Kelo, and so things weren't taking effect yet. These new restrictions uh-huh. put in place weren't taking effect yet. So folks could go to ij.org if they wanted and find this eminent domain activity data. And our paper, by the way, you could get at mercatus.org. That's Mercatus.
All right. We're exploring results of a recent study on government use of eminent domain that challenges the notion that eminent domain works as an effective tool for economic redevelopment. We're speaking with the report's authors, FGCU economics professors, Drs. Carrie Karikas and Dean Stansel. You can connect with them with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 877-GCU-TALK. That's 1-877-428-8255. Join the live Twitter chat using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live or comment on Facebook at WGCU Public Media. Let's take a phone call now from Sam in Port Charlotte. Sam, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you very much. I would just like to ask your guests if some of the data in their study involved a project up here in Charlotte County that was known as Murdoch Village. I know a family who actually lost their home to eminent domain just for that purpose. A number of other homeowners did as well, and the land sits vacant today. I was just wondering if that particular project was in their data set.
Probably so. What was the timing on that? Do you remember what year that was?
It was before Charlie. It was probably about 12 years ago. And it still sits vacant.
Yeah, well, let's see. So we our data looked at a four-year period, 1998 to 2002. So that might have, that might have predated the Murdoch
Charlie
Village.
Charlie was 2004. Yeah.
Oh, well, no, maybe it may have been in the tail end of that data set. If it was between 98 and 2002, that big of a project, because I know what you're talking about, that very well should have been in there. Again, that's not the date. We weren't the collectors of that data, but I would be pretty confident to say that if it was in that time frame, it was in there.
Okay, because it's certainly not a reassuring example to support the argument here, believe me.
Exactly.
We thank you for that example confirming our findings.
Writing that down. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. And how have your findings shown that eminent domain use for private purposes doesn't only have a no positive impact on employment, but is actually associated with slower employment growth?
Well, so in this particular paper, we were looking at the specifically at the revenue effects. So we didn't examine the employment effects. I know there's someone else out there who has done a paper on that, and we were going to take what they did and kind of build on it. But that's for the future. That's a future paper for us. We'll come back and talk about that one too.
All right. Thanks.
But look, I think you could answer indirectly in the sense if there was a big employment effect, that's going to carry over into revenue. And so revenue is ultimately the thing they say, oh, it's going to bring us more dollars to spend. And if there weren't more dollars to spend, then there probably wasn't more employment. But you know, there are other factors, of course.
And Dean, let's touch on how the concept of secure property rights comes into play here when we're talking about the possibility that one's private property could be taken by a government or another private for another private purpose.
Sure. So and my colleague, Carrie Karikas, is an expert on economic development. But one of the things that examples I like to use is look at Cuba, just to the south of us, and where private property rights essentially don't exist, and where the standards of living are exactly essentially what they were when Castro took over and eliminated private property. I mean, that's one example of where, you know, you've got two bodies of land right near each other, same resources essentially, one poor, one rich. Look at North Korea and South Korea. Mm-hmm. South Korea is booming in a sense compared to North Korea. North Korea is dark at night because the only place they have lights is in the capital. And it's all about the ability of entrepreneurs to have secure property rights so they can expand their business with confidence that when they come to their shop the next day, their stuff hasn't been stolen either by the government or just by the fact that property rights aren't protected.
Understood. And how would you characterize the security of property rights in the U.S., I guess today versus historically?
Going down.
Going down.
Things are getting worse. They have over time. You know, there's a report I'm involved with by a think tank up in Canada called the Fraser Institute. And they rank the countries on economic freedom. We call it economic freedom. And one of the components of that is property rights. And we've been going downhill in that report for years. I work with them on the one that ranks the states and the provinces and such called Economic Freedom of North America. And it's a little harder to measure at the state level. But yeah, the U.S. is now less free than Canada, believe it or not, according to the economic freedom measures.
And I know, Dean, that's, you know, the Economic Freedom of the World report and Freedom of North America report are topics that you and I have discussed in the past. Can you maybe give us some highlights from the 2014 report in regards to how the U.S. or Florida specifically might be doing compared to years past?
Sure. So Florida is a unique case for better or for worse. So we rank 21st among the 50 states, and I know a lot of people say, well, that's way too low. But one of the issues that compounds this, well, number one, we have increased spending a lot lately. And other there's another measure the Mercatus Center puts out on economic freedom. They're ranked in the 20s with that study. The Cato Institute ranks the governors. Governor Scott got a D in their report last year, largely because of high spending growth. But ultimately, we're handicapped on these reports in the sense that about, well, I don't know what the number is, but a fairly substantial percentage of our revenue, taxes are basically exported to tourists who come here for either live here part-time or just down for the week on vacation. And very few other states can say anything near to how much of an impact we have that has on our size of government. So we're spending that money, and granted, we could return it with tax cuts. But ultimately, that bumps us down in this type of report. For example, the Tax Foundation put out a report on business tax climate. We're ranked 5th. I think that's probably closer to the truth. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, I think the more important overall point here is that if you look at those states with the highest levels of economic freedom and compare them to the lowest, for example, in the three most free states, you've got Texas, South Dakota, North Dakota, their average personal income is about 20% higher than in the least free states, which are Maine, Vermont, and Mississippi. And so you've got about 48,000 versus 40,000. And you look at two states, again, kind of neighbors, Rhode Island, or relative neighbors, Rhode Island versus New Hampshire. Rhode Island is ranked 45th. New Hampshire is ranked 5th. Unemployment 7% in Rhode Island, 4% in New Hampshire. In the top 10 states, employment grew by roughly 3.5%, while it's barely budged in the bottom 10. And economic growth in those top 10 states grew more than 8% and by only about 2% in the bottom 10. So freeing up entrepreneurs to be successful, to expand their businesses, to hire new workers, which is good for everyone, not just those at the top, is a good kind of recipe for economic prosperity.
Oh, and I think it speaks volumes that the idea of property rights security is one of the, you know, just a handful of factors that really go into these rankings from the Fraser Institute. It really sort of shows how important that specific factor is in a functioning free market. And I know the Fraser Institute is considered by some sort of a conservative leaning think tank. What about the results of your report? This was first released back in October. What's the response been so far?
Are you talking about the eminent domain or the
– The eminent domain.
Oh, right. So we've got a good bit of press out of this thing, and it's a working paper. So it's for a working paper series that Mercatus Center puts out, and we've got a good bit of press for a working paper. There was an op-ed in the Detroit News just the other day. We had a piece in the Daily Caller and Real Clear – or no, ours was in Real Clear Policy. Daily Caller put something out on it. It's been good, and ultimately it's a working paper, so we're still looking to get it published as an academic journal article. That's kind of in the works. But overall, I think it's been well received.
Well, and this is challenging some notions that as you point out, haven't been challenged much. Are your findings generally accepted by, say, elected policymakers and academics and business and economic fields, or is this really something of a game changer?
I would say in terms of academics, it may be split. You've had other people that have looked at this at eminent domain in general, maybe not this particular angle that we're taking. When it comes to politicians and things, I would say if you're wanting to spend or develop, then the findings might not help you in that regard. So I don't know that they'd be as favorable toward.
Sure. I mean, if you're a politician, what do you want to do? You want to have these ribbon cutting ceremonies, right, where you have all the dignitaries out and you get the photo and the news story. It makes you look like someone who's done something really important. And so if you tell them, well, this actually doesn't work. Well, they don't want to hear that, so they basically ignore it or say you've done something wrong. But we haven't. I haven't heard of any sort of response like that from anyone in the political realm. But my assumption is that's how they would look at it. Is that this is our bread and butter? Don't make us stop.
Sure, sure. And you know, as the U.S. Supreme Court considers a Florida case this week, you know, regarding solicitation of campaign contributions by candidates for elected judgeships, we've been reminded a lot in the news about the Citizens United ruling 5 years ago. And the only reason I bring this up is because we've been hearing about ongoing efforts to get the Citizens United ruling overturned. Are you aware of, or would you support any such efforts to repeal the Kelo decision?
To repeal the Kelo decision? Oh, that'd be great. Oh, am I aware of any efforts? No.
No.
No. And again, I think the states somewhat made it a moot point in the fact that so many states have stepped up and restricted it and been able to, in a sense, overturn it indirectly, but not entirely. And so I do think it was an outlier, you know, in terms of the overall sentiment of the court. I think that I was certainly surprised. A lot of people who follow it more closely than I do were surprised at the ruling back then.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of your research, either for this working paper or just for other research that you've done, is there anything you can tell us about the in terms of characterizing the use of eminent domain by governments here in Florida?
I haven't looked specifically at anything in Florida, but that caller had a good example. I'm sure that you could investigate it, and there'd be some neat studies you could do looking at Florida. My research has been more general, looking at property rights, mm-hmm. Just how they matter for overall economic development. I'm usually looking at an international level, and I have a co-author, Claudia Williamson, that we have several papers that look at the relationship between property rights and economic development. And one of the things that some of the papers will tell you and explain is that property rights are important as a foundation for a well-working market system. If you don't have property rights, you're not going to have trade and exchange. Dean already pointed out the importance of entrepreneurship, but all of that's going to lead to capital formation and investment, and ultimately we hope economic growth. So anything that's undermining that is going to then have a negative effect on economic growth, which is why we were so outraged at the Kelo decision and why we've started investigating that more for those long-run effects that it may have.
Sure. I mean, I think the takeaway for the listener is that we ought to be more skeptical when politicians tell us we're going to seize this private property and it's going to bring all these future financial windfalls. In reality, hampering on private property rights may make economic growth worse and make things worse rather than better.
All right. And do you, either of you plan to follow up on this paper, maybe do more extensive research in the future?
Actually, the one you mentioned, looking at employment growth, is our next project. Mm-hmm. We haven't gotten very far yet. But it's on the list. So.
All right. Well, that'll be a future conversation.
Absolutely.
On the program.
Absolutely. So thanks for having us.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the show. But thank you, Carrie and Dean, for joining us.
Great.
Thanks, you very much.
Drs. Carrie Karikas and Dean Stansel are professors of economics at the Luckert School of Business here at Florida Gulf Coast University. Their study on eminent domain was released last fall by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. You can find a link to the full report on our website at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live and also at the Mercatus website as well. We're taking a short break, but when we return, we sit down with acclaimed artist and living legend Peter Max. A retrospective exhibition of some of his most iconic paintings comes to the Mercato in Naples, and Max himself will make an appearance at the exhibition this weekend. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU, NPR for Southwest Florida.